Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio and shortwave radio, too, for that matter. Today, well, you don't want to touch that dial because today we've got N7VE, John Hayes from Seattle, Washington. He's going to talk all about D-Star. A lot of people writing emails saying, we want to hear some more about D-Star, some of the new modes. So that's what we're going to do today. And also, N2BR Bobby Raymer. They've got a special event station coming up for Christmas, as well as Bobby kind of fills us in on his DX operations in the bottom of the sunspot cycle. So we've got both of these fellows on. It's going to be a really good QSO, and it's going to start right after this. It operates 20 through 10 meters. It's stealth. It will keep up with any three-element beam and any vertical that you have on your property. But if you can't have a three-element beam or a vertical on your property, you can still have a TW2010. It is stealth. It disappears. We tried to take pictures of it, and we had to move the thing around because it hides so well. There is no compromise in performance with this antenna, and it's portable. You can take it with you on vacation. It's quite unique. They make several flavors of this antenna, however. If you want to operate 80, 40, 60, 30-meter band, it's all there. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com, and check out the special pricing right now. Here at QSO, we've got something new, and that's a prize closet. And we are in the process of filling that prize closet up. And we're going to be telling you on the air some of the items that we've got in the prize closet. If you'd like to win some of these things, we'd love to see you do that. But what you've got to do is send us an email. Go up to the website, tedrandall.com or qsoradioshow.com. And when you go to that website, just simply send us an email. Say hello, tell us where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, if you're listening by podcast. Tell us how you have joined this radio show. And then put a little note in there that says, I want to win. And we'll put your name in the hat, and we will have a drawing twice a month, and we're going to be giving away what's in our prize closet. Now, I can't tell you everything that's in there so far, but we'll be posting those items up on the website, and we'll be telling you about them on the air. But don't miss out. Send us an email and put in that email, I want to win. And let's see who the lucky winners will
be. Our guest is John Hayes, K7VE. And how are you doing today, John?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well. Nice sunny but cold day here in the Seattle area.
Well, I'm in Tennessee, so our weather's quite a bit different than yours. But it's nice to hear that you got sunshine going on somewhere here. That's... I guess the question I would like to ask you, or I'd like to get into a discussion about, is you have an intense interest in D-Star, and this is a subject and an area that we have done no coverage of at all. We have not talked about D-Star. We haven't discussed it. I know I get emails in from people all the time that say, I haven't got the slightest idea what it is. Can you recommend a book? Can you talk to me about... Can you tell me what it is? You know, and of course, now a lot of the shows we do, I get comments from people saying, hey, you know, I'm so glad you did that show. We did one on Echolink here not too long ago, and there was a lot of people that had no idea what to do with Echolink. You know, and of course, okay. I can navigate Echolink, okay, but I haven't done anything at all with any of the digital modes in terms of, like, when I say digital, true digital, like D-Star, and there's also... some of the digital stuff going on the HF bands. But D-Star is primarily VHF, UHF. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Certainly that's where D-Star lives today, is in the VHF, UHF realm. As I read the U.S. regulations, it's pretty specific what is a legal signal to be on the phone bands in the HF spectrum. And I certainly would encourage you to read the rules yourself and make sure that my understanding's correct. But D-Star, as I read the regulations, fits within the parameters for the modulation index to run on HF and, in fact, on most of the bands. ICOM is building a new radio that'll be released sometime in 2010 that includes D-Star on the 6 meters through 23 centimeters band, exclusive of 220 and 900 megahertz, which are not available globally. But they have also extended that down into the 10-meter band, as some people have some questions whether you could go below that. But as I say, my reading would indicate that you probably could, but we'd want to get clarification on that.
Well, I know we were at some location. I can't remember where it was. We were kind of out in the middle of the boonies. And there was a couple of guys there had D-Star set up, and I said, well, I have email on my phone, you know, but I said, I'm going to go run over here and check my email. And this guy said, oh, no, do it right here. And I said, well, how? He said, oh, I've got D-Star. We've got internet access right here. So that might be one of the very first things that guys might ask a question about. How does that work? What kind of voodoo are they using to do this now?
Okay. Well, let's get some terminology and modes out of the way for D-Star, and then that will begin to answer your question. D-Star, unlike most of the other VHF, UHF, internet networked communication systems, is digital from the radio at origination to the radio at the destination. So if you talk on into a microphone on a D-Star radio, it is immediately converted to ones and zeros and modulates the carrier, goes out. If it gets relayed or through a repeater or through the internet or any other method like that and comes out to the radio at the far end, it arrives and is demodulated back to ones and zeros, and then those ones and zeros are reformed into the audio signal. So this is different than, say, Echolink or some of the other VoIP technologies like AllStarLink and IRLP, in that they're basically just taking the audio off of a standard FM carrier, converting it to digital, sending it across the internet, turning it back to voice, and sending it back out as audio over radio. Well, the infrastructure for that on the voice side we call digital voice, and digital voice carries the human voice very intelligibly in about 2400 bits per second, and the digital voice signal by definition is 4800 bits per second. It fits in 6.25 kilohertz of bandwidth. And you're saying to yourself, well, 4800 and 2400, what's going on there? Well, in addition to encoding the voice, it puts a forward error correction on it. And then that leaves 1200 bits left over that we can use for data of various types, sending GPS positions, sending email, sending text messages, doing all manner of things. There's another mode on D-Star called digital data. It currently only runs on 23 centimeters at 128 kilobits per second. And what it looks like inside of its data stream is a series of Ethernet packets. So in essence, you can take your computer and plug it into a digital data D-Star radio from its Ethernet connection, plug the other end into the internet or another computer, and all of your programs that run over TCP/IP or the internet protocols just work. Now, you have to be careful of some of the regulations about commercial content and no encryption and so on. But if you keep it clean and simple, yes, you can walk up to a computer attached to a D-Star digital data radio and run your mail program, run your web browser, run applications like Google Maps and those kinds of things, and there's some great application for that type of technology in the D-Star space.
Well, I guess my question is what about the regulations in terms of if you're logged in or you've got a computer plugged into a D-Star radio, and then you're browsing the web and you wind up on some commercial websites? Is that considered taboo? Or I mean, you understand what I'm saying? The words, I get a little aggravated sometimes at all the hair splitting over rules, if that makes any sense. I mean, it's like, we've got some hams among us that have no idea what the word common sense means. And, they want to split hairs over every little rule, every little regulation and all that. I heard all this mess about these people that are employed by a hospital. And then there's a drill at that hospital. And then those people are not permitted to operate the radio because they're employed by the hospital, And I've never heard such nonsense in all my life. In other words, a lot of these guys have dedicated and committed all their time to getting the hospital they work for to be able to put the radios in and connect this hospital up to an emergency amateur radio network. I mean, they're not doing it for their employer. They're not, in reality working for their employer. They're actually working for the community, to connect this local community hospital to a network. And I listened to all that, and you talk about ignorance gone to seed in bringing out a hundredfold return. I had never heard anything. I never thought I would ever hear or see anything like that, but I did. So I was very, very disappointed. So I guess my question, and please understand where I'm coming from. I'm a bit radical at times, but if you if you plug a computer into a D-Star radio and you go to Google, and all of a sudden you wind up on RF Parts' site looking at inductors, have you broken the law? I wonder.
Well, in my opinion, and of course, you take two ham radio operators together and ask them an opinion on a rule, and you'll get 10 different ideas what it means. But my opinion is this runs back to the can you order a pizza over an auto patch rule, which basically the question was asked of the FCC, can you order a pizza for your little ham gathering over an auto patch? And the ruling came back, yes, you can. The key there is that you are not benefiting yourself or your employer in a pecuniary way. So I can't run an RF parts store over the web and sell stuff directly as a business over amateur radio. But as an amateur, if I just happen to browse onto a site, then if I understand the pizza ruling, then yeah, I can go to that commercial site and look stuff up. I probably would not buy over that site because my credit card information and personal information would be in the clear because we can't run those encryption algorithms over the air. But certainly looking up information or anything like that, I don't see where that violates the rules, at least in the U.S.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I had heard so much about the situation with the hospitals, and I know a lot of folks that have really dedicated a lot of their time, effort, and energy to participating in these emergency drills and being part of a network that actually connects a hospital, And I went to a physician. There's a friend of mine, and I happened to go to this guy as a doctor. And he was relating to me that, and I'll tell you, he's in Hartsville, Tennessee, and it was the little Trousdale Medical Center. And he said that when the tornado came through there, they had no communications if it wasn't for some ham operator. And, of course, some time ago, I mean, this goes back a ways, I wanted to get a group together because I was, at that time, I was living in Trousdale County for a while. And it's a small community. And I suggested that we put something at the hospital and that we get a few of the local hams together. There was probably maybe four or five living in the whole county, but at least, organized loosely. And I was told by some ogre that was running the ARES at the time, it's not necessary. The adjacent county can do this. You know, I said, oh, okay, fine. So I backed it off, and I didn't say another word. But then later, my doctor told me, he said, man, he said, after the tornado, he said, now we've got radios, we've got amateur radio gear in the hospital. And he said, if it wasn't for this one ham, he said, we would have had no communication in and out of here for medical information and whatnot, you know. So I can see where that's, like, invaluable. I mean, you know, if for some reason a hospital gets cut off, phone system goes down, they can't do anything, and then they've got a bunch of hams there that can actually communicate back and forth to an adjoining hospital or wherever else they've got to go. If they've got to get a helicopter in from Vanderbilt or someplace, you know, that's a little bit more set up for trauma, I can. This makes a lot of sense to me. And for someone to come along and say, because the guy works for the hospital, then he can't use the radio, it brings me into a situation where I'm saying to myself, okay, then, if that's the case, then how many people that work for the ARRL can run W1AW? You see, I mean, and that's really nuts. I mean, a person should be able to work for the ARRL and run W1AW without anybody even raising an eyebrow. You know, I mean, that's just, it's like I said, ignorance gone to seed. But I wondered about that because I thought having internet access by means of a D-Star radio would be a real milestone, especially if we could, and I, if someone had written me a letter and I'd made this comment to someone about, they had suggested that amateurs try to put together some sort of a network over RF that would function and work similar to the internet. And of course I scratched my head and I said, boy, that's over my head. That's way out of my classification. But I know there's guys out there that could actually create that and make it work. And then someone said, well, they've already got it in D-Star. So, you know, and I wondered about that. I wondered how that worked. Well, let's get off of my soapbox here because I've, you know, now I've run half the audience off. I've got everybody mad now. The question I have is, how did D-Star come about? Who created it? Whose product is it? Is it a product? Is it a mode? Kind of define that, because I think a lot of folks are confused about that, including myself.
Okay. Great question. D-Star, the name D-Star is for Digital Smart Technologies for Amateur Radio. It was invented by the Japanese Amateur Radio League, or the JARL, and right around the turn of the millennium, they got a grant from the Japanese government to do the research and put together this protocol for doing digital communications over amateur radio. That protocol uses some very set standards. The on-air protocol has been translated from Japanese to English and is available at the ARRL site. So if you want to go and look at how that protocol works, you can look at it there. The protocol is, the documentation of that standard is open. Anyone can implement it. There are people around the world that are doing that. As far as commercial products go, the only major radio manufacturer right now making radios that do the D-Star protocol is ICOM out of Japan. And so a lot of people get confused that it's an ICOM product. ICOM does have products that do D-Star, but D-Star can be done without ICOM. So that's the key. In fact, last night at my home, I built a D-Star repeater, and we're talking a full duplex repeater. There was not a single piece of ICOM equipment in it. I used two Yaesu radios for the receiver and the transmitter, a piece of software written by a fellow out of the UK, Jonathan Taylor, Jonathan Naylor, that handled looking at the bits and making sure everything was running properly and sending it back out the transmitter. It can also hook up to the software that allows it to connect over the internet. And it used a sound card to do the modem capability. Now, I need to make some clarification right there. Since everything's digital, you can just run through the modem, get the bits out of the receive signal, and put them out on the transmitted signal again. But you could not take that set of bits and have voice. That takes a special chip. It's the one proprietary commercial piece of the whole thing. It uses a standard called AMBI, and that's, I forget the A, multi-band excitation. It's a way to compress voice and put it in a digital format and take it out, and you have to buy their chip in order to do it. It's heavily patented. But it's widely used, and it's very inexpensive. You can buy a single chip for about $20. Of course, you have to put support circuitry around that. But to do the repeater, as I said, there was no ICOM equipment involved in that. ICOM has also written some software to go on the back of their repeaters that connects one repeater to another through what's called the gateway. And we, in fact, have a worldwide network of repeaters that use this gateway system. And you can, the D-Star signal actually embeds the call sign of the sending station, the receiving station, and the repeater in between. And so let's say that I wanted to call you, and I assumed you were in Tennessee, but I didn't know for sure. So I put your call sign in the to field, and my call sign would be in the from field, and I would put my local repeater's call sign in the repeater field, and I'd key the mic. Well, what would happen is this software on the back end would look at your call sign as coming through the repeater, and it'd say, well, where is he? And if you happen to be in Tennessee, it would send the signal to the repeater in Tennessee that you were last on. If you happen to be in Atlanta, it would pick up the signal and send it to Atlanta. If you happen to be in London, it would pick up the signal and send it to London without me knowing or caring where you really were. And that's kind of a cool thing, I think, in D-Star. And I used to be a road warrior for work, and it would have been really nice for my wife to be able to just pick up the microphone and say, honey, what are you doing? And it wouldn't have mattered if I was in Melbourne or Copenhagen. She could have picked me up. So there's so much more to go on to that, but that kind of gives you the very basics of some of the things that you can do with D-Star. Also, because of this data subchannel, the data travels with the voice. The voice travels with the data. There's no separation. You can't send one without the other. If you're not talking, then it's dead air. If you're not sending text, then it's just empty text, but it's still in the signal. And there's a fellow in Oregon, KK7DS, that's written this great piece of software called DRATS, and you can find that at www.d-rats.com. It's a little play there. DRATS is D-Star spelled backwards after the hyphen. And that little piece of software will do, well, you just have to go look at it. It'll do take GPS positions from radios and put it on a map. It'll do email. It'll do file transfer. It'll send pictures. And all of this at the same time you're talking on the radio.
This is kind of mind-boggling. And I'm not sure I totally absorbed everything that you just said. and considered the selective...
I'm not sure I did either.
The selective fading we get on shortwave, so we may have to repeat a little bit of this. Now, okay, if you have a D-Star system, you know, you've got the radio, and assuming there's a D-Star repeater in your area, and then there's maybe other guys that are working D-Star on Simplex or however. What is it that you're going to be able to do? Now, you explained this whole thing, but now this is something that you can't do conventionally, let's say on a 2-meter FM or a regular 2-meter radio, even with data transmission? I mean, what is, I guess I'll say, what advantage do we have? What uniqueness is there in this system that gives us the edge over conventional FM and normal modes of single sideband and AM and all that sort of thing on, say, let's just take 2 meters and use 2 meters as an example.
Okay. Well, number one, this is the digital voice mode, but digital voice is a little bit of a misnomer because it's really all just ones and zeros. It's all data. And you can mix the data and the voice at the same time, the same exact time on the same radio. So when I'm keying my mic on my mobile radio on 2 meters in my Jeep as I'm going down the road, it's not only sending my voice to the repeater or to the simplex station on the other end. At the same exact time, it's also sending my position because I have a GPS hooked up to it. It's sending a little text message that I put in that, might have my email address in it or something like that that I want people to see. And additionally, if I had a computer hooked up to it, I could be sending files, I could be sending pictures, I could be doing any of those things simultaneously while talking on the radio. Now, there's a bunch of complexities that get in there. I mean, the laws of physics still apply. You can't have one person talking on his radio and another one you're doing data on the same frequency. But as long as I have the frequency and I'm transmitting, I can do all of those things in one radio signal that's only 6.25 kilohertz wide. And if you look at our band plans, there's some debate as to what optimum spacing is, but certainly it runs well at 12.5 kilohertz spacing. So if we took the 70 centimeter band, where in the U.S. most repeaters are at 25 kilohertz spacing through the band, we could instantly double that if every one of them went to D-Star. We could have twice as many repeaters in the same amount of frequency. So that's another advantage of it. And the third one that I was just highlighting there was the ability for you to designate who you want to talk to the radio and just let the network go find that person. You don't have to know where they are, what frequency they're on, or any of that in order to contact that single person anywhere in the world that you want to talk to that happens to be on D-Star when you're on D-Star.
I can see the digital mode. I mean, like, for example, that I can understand you can transmit data and audio at the same time. And with a lot of folks that maybe don't quite understand that, and I can't imagine any that don't, but nonetheless, it's a lot like in your car, a car radio now, where when you are listening to the music, the display on the radio is telling you the name of the artist and the title of the song and maybe some other message that's of commercial nature. But anyways, it all goes out at the same time, so you're able to hear the analog audio. And, of course, they do that on satellite. That might even be a better analogy, that XM and Sirius transmit the data to the songs and the information along with the music at the same time, all coming down the same channel. Is that a good analogy? Is that somewhere? Am I in the ballpark?
That's a perfect analogy. In fact, I think it's Sirius that uses this same AMBE encoding to put their analog signal and their data on a single carrier and send it out. Albeit at a faster rate, because you need a higher fidelity for music than just the human voice. But yes, that's a perfect analogy.
If you had a D-Star net going, and let's just say, for example, you were handling an Amber Alert or something, and then you had some kid off somewhere missing, how is it as far as being able to transmit pictures, and maybe some limited low-speed video, or how far can you go with this on the data channel?
Well, on the digital voice and the data that's there, you've only got about 1,200 bits per second, and it actually comes out to about 960 after you take out some of the overhead on it. And you can send still pictures on that using programs like DRATS, which I mentioned earlier, which incidentally is free and runs on Windows and Macintosh and on Linux. It's kind of universal. You could send text files. You can send beacons with alerts. Basically, if you imagine it, you probably can do it. I wouldn't try video there. You could maybe do something loosely approximating slow scan television, but it would be still pictures. Up on the 128 kilobit service on 23 centimeters, one could send a very low frame rate, lower resolution video signal and have pretty reasonable picture coming out the other end.
Yeah, you know, the only reason I ask about that, but picture this. Imagine being, and maybe this is way out there, but imagine being stuck in an area where a doctor has got to do some medical procedures or something, and you could have a doctor on the other end and they could be watching what this guy's doing, you know, or at least guiding him through it. I things like that go through my mind. I'm thinking, you know, our amateur radio service, what can we do to accommodate, you know, during emergencies and crisis? How far can we stretch the rubber band? You know, that goes through my head. And I just wondered, and I may be outclassing this thing. Is getting into D-Star, as far as if you own no equipment at all today, what can a person, what's entry level? I mean, what could you get into D-Star, you know, for dollars and cents wise?
Okay. Well, there's a couple of ways to get your feet wet. I like people to buy radios, and the radios are more expensive than your standalone FM radio. They've got more technology in them. The manufacturer, of course, is still recouping some of their R&D investment. But you can get into, I haven't looked in prices for a while, but for, in the $300 to $400 price band, you can get into a nice handheld dual band D-Star radio. Some people are saying, ouch, but I don't know how long you've been in radio, but I've been in long enough that in today's dollars, I bought the venerable IC2AT synthesized 2-meter radio with a touch tone pad on it. And in today's dollars, it would have been about $900. And some odd dollars if you do the currency conversion, the value of money over time. And it had thumbwheel switches to select a single channel. It had touch tones, but if you wanted PL or CTCSS on it, you had to go and spend another $70 or $80 and wire it in yourself and so on. So you're really getting quite a bit. And you're getting, and if you compared that, say, to you wanted to do both data or APRS and voice, first of all, you'd have to buy two radios because you can't do both on the same signal at the same time in traditional FM, and you'd have to buy the TNC and everything, and it actually comes out more expensive than what you get in the single radio. You can get a nice mobile for in the $500 range, brand new. And, of course, there's always some on the used market for a bit less.
So you can't do your global positioning on the same radio that you're talking on, or you can? I mean, how?
You can on D-Star. You would not be able to, say, on FM. You would either be APRS or you would be voice, but you couldn't do both at the same time.
Okay, that I understand, but I was confused. I thought you were saying that D-Star was the same way. You'd have to have two radios. But with D-Star,
nope. You
can have the digital burst that has all that information on it going out while you're talking. So the other person, their radio can be connected up to a computer, and as soon as you begin to transmit, they've got your text information that you sent. They've got your position. It automatically probably calls up a map and puts a dot on the map as to where you are. And I guess if you wanted to encode digitally, you know, what you had for breakfast that morning, it'd probably deliver that as well, and maybe even cross-link onto the web and bring up the type of cornflakes that you ate. I don't know. I mean, it's just...
Yep, you could do that. Train's going past. We'll edit this little piece out here. Okay. Yes, and it does. And in fact, particularly the newer D-Star radios, if you're listening to a station that is sending the GPS positioning information, it will actually do the bearing and distance between you and that station. So you can see that station is 3.5 miles north by northwest from you.
No, that's
on
amazing.
On the display of your radio.
That's totally amazing. I guess the other thing I was going to ask about is, in regards to, you were talking about HTs, and you were talking about regular mobiles that you would buy, a mobile rig. What about range, distance, and coverage as compared to conventional FM?
The general answer to that is it all depends. on average, they're about the same in coverage. The big difference that you'll experience on D-Star is, one, you've got a little bit narrower signal, so, you know, 10 watts with a 6.25 kilohertz wide signal on it has more effective distance than the same 10 watts with, say, a 10 kilohertz wide signal on it. So you're getting a little better power concentration on your signal going out. That's not going to make a lot of difference. The digital nature of it, though, with the forward error correction that is part of the signal, makes the clarity of that signal much, much better. And so you would be able to, let's say that you had two stations and they were on simplex, so we're taking all the variables out. As station B moves away from station A on FM, you would get more and more noise on the signal, static, if you would, until it drops down to a point where you're still making out what the station B is saying, but there's a lot of noise and it's very irritating. On the digital side, there's basically three states. You get the voice as it was transmitted, totally clear, no interference, no dropout, no fade. And that goes very, very deep into the noise floor. And then you'll get to this little area where you get what we refer to as R2D2. The packets start getting out of order because you're starting to roll off and lose the signal totally. And it sounds like the Star Wars character R2D2 talking. And then you have nothing. So either you have a perfectly clear signal, you've got, I'm just on the hairy edge, or I've got nothing. And that's the experience on D-Star. In fact, a lot of us that are on D-Star now, we flip over to FM, and even on strong signals, we're going, there's all this extraneous noise in the background. We just want to hear the communication, and that's the difference. Some repeater sites that have both analog and D-Star at the same location, even sharing the same antenna, estimate about 10 to 15% improvement on D-Star, but that can be offset by some other factors. So we just say in general they cover about the same area.
I guess what you were talking about, we were talking about price and entry level and all that kind of stuff. You know, it seems like, I mean, I don't know, what is the little Kenwood THF6 run now? What does it cost? They're about $300, aren't they, for a little handheld? Isn't that about,
something like that,
about ballpark? Yeah, and they're a pretty standard little radio that people pick up as a dual band. I don't know how many people use the 220 portion on it. But what you're saying is a D-Star handheld. You can get into a D-Star handheld for about the same amount of money, somewhere in that ballpark.
Yeah, it, you know, you put them side by side, the D-Star entry radio dual band is going to be a little bit more, but it has a lot more in it from an intelligence point of view.
You're listening to QSO. We'll be right back with our guest, K7VE John Hayes from Seattle, Washington, right after this.
If you like to travel, if you're a camper, if you'd like to take your ham radio hobby with you when you go, you need the Trans World Antennas TW2010L Backpacker Antenna. It's the same exact antenna as the TW2010 Adventurer, with the exception it's been streamlined for the person who likes to camp and travel light. It's the same rugged antenna structure as the TW2010, with the black powder coating and stealth design. We all know the TW2010 is a great permanent or portable antenna, but the TW2010L Backpacker takes portable and emergency operation to an entirely new level. It's especially suited for the amateur operator who loves backpacking, cycling, camping. It makes easy access and quick setup possible for the most extenuating emergencies. TW2010L Backpacker Antenna is available now for a limited time for only $399.95. That's right, $399.95. Pricing includes backpacker, quadra stand, carrying bag, and free shipping in the continental United States through FedEx Ground. That's transworldantennas.com. And now for a limited time, only $399.95. That's transworldantennas.com.
At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, I want to win. Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast, but be sure and put on that email, I want to win. Because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, I want to win. Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, R-A-N-D-A-L-L. And we'll look for your email. And now back to our guest, John Hayes, K7VE. From Seattle, Washington, talking about D-Star on QSO. Let's, you know, I know we, when we started talking about this, you said that you were really, you know, gung-ho about the system. You really enjoyed using it. You enjoyed getting into it. What would you say to amateurs that are, you know, sitting on the edge wondering whether or not they would want to, you know, get into D-Star Digital or not? Well, what would you say to them? How would you entice them, or what would your advice be in terms of how to make a jump and get a rig and get their feet wet? Now, a lot of guys, you know, they'll buy this radio. Then they'll be afraid to use it because they're afraid they're going to let everybody know that they don't know what they're doing. You know, where unlike myself, I'm a bull in a china shop, and, you know, I just assume everybody knows I'm stupid, so I just jump in and make a fool of myself. Where does somebody start, and then how do they pick up and learn and get beyond the curve so that they can actually start using the features and making the thing work?
Okay. Well, as far as getting into it, that's more of a question of what are you wanting to do with radio. If you want to just mash to talk, as we say, push the button on the microphone and someone's running a repeater or you're doing simplex and you're just talking to your buddy across town and you're happy with that, you're probably better off spending less money and just getting an FM radio. I'm not going to pretend that, you know, D-Star is the salvation to every person's need for radio. But if you have an inquisitive mind or like to experiment or try new things, D-Star is where a lot of interesting things are happening right now. As I mentioned earlier in their interview, I built a repeater last night. I've never built a repeater before. I kind of knew how to do it, but... The digital side of it made it interesting to me because in that radio, I can pull off this digital stream and I can write applications that talk to it. And, you know, I'm a software guy, so that's interesting to me. There are other guys that are into RF and they're figuring out, you know, how close can we put this together? How strong can two adjacent signals be and still have communication on both channels and so on. So as far as making that decision to make the jump, that really is an examination of what you as an individual are looking to get out of the hobby. As far as emergency communications, a lot of emergency groups are going to the D-Star because of the clarity of the signal on voice and the ability to do data at the same time. So if you're in one of those groups, this might be an interesting technology for you. As far as learning to use it, the most simple way to use D-Star is you put your call sign in the radio, and there's software to help you do that. You just plug the thing into your computer and set it up, or you can do it through the keyboard on the radio itself. You set the destination rather than a specific station you want to talk to. You just set it to CQ, 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 which is I'm calling any station, just like on other ham modes. And you key the mic and you talk. That's the simplest. But as you want to learn how to use the worldwide network, and we have these conference bridges called reflectors, and you want to do data communications, and you want to figure out how the GPS stuff all works, you probably want to do a little reading, find some friends, talk about it, experiment, figure it out. Don't be afraid to ask a question because we all asked them at one time. And there are some great discussion groups on the internet where you can go in if you don't have anybody local and ask the questions. One that is a good one for people just starting out is D-Star, with no hyphen in it, D-Star _ digital on the Yahoo groups, on groups.yahoo.com. Just go in and join that, and you'll be in with a few other thousand people that are exchanging information and ideas and learning and getting suggestions and figuring out how to do things. And sometimes a new piece of information will come out there that people didn't realize they could do before. Like one of the nicer mobile radios is the 2820. It's a full dual band radio, but it only does D-Star on one side at a time. But a guy up in Canada figured out how to make it into a crossband D-Star repeater and put that out on the list. And a lot of people figured you couldn't do that. And, you know, he was right, and you can make it work. And so there's a lot to learn. You know, I've been in this hobby for over 35 years, and part of the reason that I'm still enthusiastic about the hobby is there's always something new to do, something new to learn, and even within an area like D-Star, there's always something new, always something to learn, and that's what I encourage people to do if they're interested in looking at the mode.
Is there a competitive digital mode, something that works, that is digital, that is, I guess I want to say, competition to D-Star in terms of...
Well, there's good question. There's a few things out there. There's a protocol called Moto Turbo, done by Motorola. They have a pretty good integration of voice and data, and they do both analog and digital on the same repeater. There's one that's an industry standard called P25, which is the based on the APCO 25 specification, which is designed to help public safety agencies have interoperability of radios, and they have digital modes and analog modes. There's NXDN, which you can buy from either Kenwood or from ICOM, which also has digital modes. But there's a couple of things to keep in mind with that. One is that if you look at, say, the P25 system, great system, and you can start getting some of the surplus first-generation stuff off of eBay and from old radio shops for a fairly reasonable price. But by its nature, it was designed for public safety agencies where you have a radio shop that programs the thing, hands it to you, and you have, you know, your 10 channels or 24 channels or 190 channels, whatever it is that you can go through. But it's not really designed like ham radio where, you know, the operator does all of those things. They do the setup, and if they get called out on an emergency, they can go out and they can reset up their radio for the group that they're interacting with and so on. The other thing is that D-Star, it was designed for hams. The call sign is digitally transmitted every time you key your microphone or send out a data transmission in the digital data mode. And as I read the FCC rules, at least in the United States, you have legally ID'd every time you key the microphone. You don't have to say it again on voice. We all do because that's just the habit we have. Not so on some of these other modes. P25, for example, does not have that. One version from one vendor allows you to put a call sign in, but it is not part of the standard. And so you have to actually step out of the mode to ID every 10 minutes and then step back into it. So, but yeah, there are other ones out there. There are people putting up repeaters on some of those, playing with them. I mean, there's enough room in the playground for everybody. But when it comes to amateur radio-focused digital communications, on VHF, UHF, and super high frequencies, D-Star is by and far the leader, and none of them, except for D-Star, has the world interconnectivity, over 500 repeater systems tied together in a digital network that you can address and so on. And those systems may have up to 3 repeaters or 4 repeaters in them, so who knows? And maybe there's 1,000 repeaters on that one network. It's pretty transparent and pretty clear because of the digital signals.
So now what you're saying and what you were saying before is it's possible to, through D-Star, to digitally link through a local repeater through the network to a repeater somewhere on the other side of the earth and talk to somebody in a digital mode, you know, just as if you were talking to someone across town.
Yes, exactly. And actually, there's two modes. One is what people think of in traditional linking, whether it be analog or one of the VoIP networks like IRLP, Echolink, or All-Star, where you're tying one repeater to another, or you're tying a repeater to some kind of a reflector that has a bunch of repeaters tied into it. That exists in D-Star as an add-on, an application, the first version of which was written by Robin Cutshaw, AA4RC in Atlanta, and is so popular you'll find it on almost every repeater. The other method is what's native in the protocol of D-Star itself, which you can address an individual radio from your radio and not actually link up. You just transmit, your voice comes out of the repeater nearest, or that remote station was most recently on, and then they can just push a button and call back to you. That also has the capability to address a repeater, but one of the nicer applications is that you can actually address an individual ham station out there in the world and not worry about what repeater they're on. The signal will just go to them.
Well, that's that's extremely interesting. Let me ask you this question. Apart from D-Star, what else do you do in amateur radio? What is it that I guess I want to say that's got your attention, that you're focused on? I'm sure that there's some other things you're into other than D-Star. I'd like to know what those are.
Well, of late, that's been my main focus. But as I mentioned earlier in the interview, I've been at this hobby for over 35 years. I love casual DXing on HF. I really enjoy VHF, UHF contesting as a rover station, going out and handing out new grids, taking my equipment portable and driving up to the top of a mountain somewhere or some remote location and hooking in with folks. For a number of years, I was quite active in the amateur television community. In fact, I was the national vice president of the Amateur Television Club for North America. I was one of the pioneers in packet radio, even before we standardized on AX25. I was on the air on packet radio, did some experimentation with TCP/IP over very slow links on amateur radio, both on HF and by linking a whole bunch of digipeters together, going hundreds of miles. Like I said, I love this hobby because there is always something new and interesting to learn about.
You're listening to QSO. We'll be right back with our guest, K7VE John Hayes from Seattle, Washington, right after this.
If you're the decision maker for any form of outdoor lighting, you're going to want to listen to this. The LightPack Systems induction lights, manufactured in the USA by a severely disabled workforce, uses a unique physical principle of light generation. This lamp system is therefore classified in a new family of sources, the LightPack induction lamp systems. LightPack induction lighting is a breakthrough for professional, general, and special lighting applications, not only because of its high luminescence and efficiency, but especially because of its unprecedented lifetime. System lifetime is rated at 100,000 hours, or about 20 years, based on 5,000 burning hours per year. With a failure rate of less than 10%. With this unmatched durability, LightPack offers substantial savings in direct maintenance costs as well as indirect costs. Induction lighting is relatively new in the United States, but it's proven technology developed in Europe over 20 years ago. Therefore, claims of durability is based on real-world empirical data, as opposed to estimated design life provided by competitive lighting technologies such as LED. LightPack Systems was founded on the principles of green solutions for modern lighting through strong partnerships with the U.S. military, the University of Central Florida, and several national energy service companies. LightPack offers lighting solutions that provide a better quality of light with a 66% energy savings, also lasting up to 5 times longer than standard lighting options. LightPack's quality shines through with their standard 10-year warranty on all products. Call today for your free demonstration. Go to their website, lightpacksystems.com. That's lightpacksystems.com, spelled LitePackSystems. LightPackSystems.com.
Week after week, you hear us talk about Transworld antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. Go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews, or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. See what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you. It's the 4040. It's a new 40-meter monoband antenna. It looks just like the Adventurer or the TW2010. It's the perfect antenna for high-performance DX communications in a portable package. This antenna system is ideal for camping, emergencies, or permanent installation where you gotta go stealth. 7.0 to 7.3 megahertz. Without the necessity of either manual band changing or the need for a controller. Just attach the feed line and you're ready to talk. That's the Trans World Adventurer 4040. Go to their website. Take a look. Transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. Here at QSO, we've got something new, and that's a prize closet. And we are in the process of filling that prize closet up. And we're going to be telling you on the air some of the items that we've got in the prize closet. If you'd like to win some of these things, we'd love to see you do that. But what you've got to do is send us an email. Go up to the website, tedrandall.com or qsoradioshow.com. And when you go to that website, just simply send us an email. Say hello. Tell us where you're listening, how the signal's coming in. If you're listening by podcast, tell us how you have joined this radio show. And then put a little note in there that says, I want to win. And we'll put your name in the hat, and we will have a drawing twice a month, and we're going to be giving away what's in our prize closet. Now, I can't tell you everything that's in there so far, but we'll be posting those items up on the website, and we'll be telling you about them on the air. But don't miss out. Send us an email and put in that email, I want to win. And let's see who the lucky winners will be. And now back to our guest, John Hayes, K7VE from Seattle, Washington, talking about D-Star on QSO. Well, how early did you get started, and what was it that got you into ham radio? And what was your beginnings in this hobby? How did you, what kicked you in this direction, and then what was it that grabbed you and wouldn't let loose?
Well, when I was a very young child, I lived in Utah, and I had a set of cousins, and they had a ham station. And I must have been 6, 7 years old, and I was just totally fascinated that they could talk into this little box and talk to people all over the world. And that still intrigues me, even though I understand how it works now. It still has a bit of magic to it. Back then, you had to learn the Morse code, and you had to pass a theory test. Well, I probably could have passed all the theory tests by the time I was 10 or 11 years old, because I read everything, and I didn't have a mentor or anybody at that point to help me out, a close family member, dad or an uncle or somebody to help me. My cousins lived remotely from me. But I always had the interest. I was a shortwave listener and so on. And I finally got to high school, and there were a couple of YL operators in town that befriended me and mentored me, and one who's unfortunately now a silent key said she'd teach me the code, and she had me come over and practice the code at her house every night, or a few nights a week, when I was a senior in high school, and we'd practice and practice, and one day she turned to me and said, you just passed the 5-word-per-minute test. I didn't even know I was taking it, but I had copied sufficiently, and this was back when novice exams were administered by volunteers, so she sent the paperwork in, and my written test came, and I was licensed my senior year of high school in 1973. I've been licensed all except for a very short period since then. We had some use it or lose it rules back in the 70s, and I was off doing some volunteer service lost the license for maybe a year, but since then I've always had a license. It was just that magic of radio that never never let go of me, and my kids give me a bad time. They're all licensed, but they all give me a bad time about still being involved with it in all of these years when we have all of these different other toys we could be playing with as well.
Well, let me ask you this. Early on, you were a shortwave listener.
Yep.
You were talking about what kind of a radio did you use, what kind of antenna did you use, and what were the stations that you remember listening to? Did you have any regular favorites that you listened to?
I was always looking for the new station. but a couple of my earliest radios, one of them was a Hallett Crafters S38. Had the main tuning dial and then the band spreader on a second dial there. And mostly just random wire antennas off of that. I also had an old military BC set of some kind. I forget the model, but it had actually kind of a digital dial, a big one in the middle that I used. And, you know, this was back during the Cold War era and stuff, and I used to love to tune in Radio Moscow and the Red Chinese stations and of course Havana, Cuba had a big signal, and HCJB had a big signal. But I'd also listen for the more remote little countries and try and see what I could pick up. I also did some broadcast band DXing, listening to programs across the U.S. and beyond the borders a bit. I was just always fascinated when I'd pull out that weak signal and finally get an ID on it.
When you were doing all this, what city were you in?
Mostly in the Mountain West, Utah, Idaho, that area.
So typically on the broadcast band, what stations were you? I'm sure you were probably trying to pull in the 5KW stations, which were more of a challenge. But of the 50,000 watt stations, did you ever do any regular listening to any of the 50KW stations?
No, I was more of a hunt and peck guy, you know, just see what I could find out there. Certainly KSL is a big signal in the western U.S. There was, XERF out of Mexico. When I lived in northern Idaho, we could get CFUN out of Vancouver, British Columbia. We used to listen to that pretty regular. In fact, there was a group of us there that used to call up the request line every once in a while and tell me, yeah, we're over here in Idaho listening to your signal, and we'd like to hear this record or make a dedication or something like that. You know, of course, the big signals, what is it out there, WGO or KGO, I can't remember the call sign now, was always big. And then it would also fascinate me. Sometimes you'd be listening to one of those big signals, and all of a sudden the ionosphere would switch on you, and some other signal would come in, and then it would switch back, and it all just fascinated me.
When you were in that area of the country, did you ever hear stations east of the Mississippi, like WLS in Chicago and WJR in Detroit, WABC, and some of those signals?
I probably did, but we're talking a few decades back now, and I can't lock down exactly which ones they would be. But yes, definitely heard a lot of the eastern stuff as well.
But now, if you were listening to the station, the Mexican station, you just gave the call sign X. What was it? X.
It's XERF,
right.
Believe was the
so. So that I believe that wasn't that the station that the Wolfman was on. Original.
I believe the Wolfman spent some time there. I had the pleasure of meeting the Wolfman in the 70s. Great guy. But yes, he came out of that signal.
I think one of the weirdest things
I think they ran 150,000 watts, so they were a little more than the 50 kWs out of that.
Yeah, there's a real interesting book out called Border Radio. I don't know if you've ever read it, but it tells the story of all of that. And I think the strangest thing I think I have ever heard in my life was hearing the Wolfman playing country music on WSM in Nashville. That was that was different, you know. But he could play anything. It didn't matter. He sat down and got behind the microphone, and he was the Wolfman. I mean, that's just all there was to it. It didn't matter what he played, you know. So, yeah. I want to say thank you so much for coming on board with us. The only other thing I'd like for you to get into just a wee bit, if you would, and then tell me about any local involvement that you're having with a local ham radio organization that you are part of, and if they're members of the league and how all that fits together. Are you active in a local amateur group?
Well, I moved to take my current job about 18, 19 months ago from out of state. I've lived in this area before, and I've gone to a couple of the old clubs that I went to. But I did join a local group down in the southwest part of the county I'm in here, Snohomish County in Washington State, called the Emergency Services Communications Agency, and they're a RACES group. That serves about seven different communities here in the area, providing emergency communication services. And we had kind of an interesting winter here last year, and we had some Seattle, for as far north as it is, doesn't get that much snow, but we had some good snows last year, and it kind of crippled the area, and we were involved in some of those activities. There was a fair amount of flooding and so on. I've been involved with them. In my last city, I actually formed one of the local club there, the Ochre Lake Radio Club in South Jordan, Utah, which is affiliated with the city there, providing emergency communication and training and mentoring of new hams. And I usually at any given point am a member of one or more radio clubs or groups, and those last two, I don't know that either of them were ARRL affiliated, but I also was an officer of the Utah Amateur Radio Club, which has had a long history with the ARRL. The club traces its roots back to about 1917, so it's been around for a while. But I do enjoy that that community involvement and being able to participate with other hams in the area just Elmering people and having a good time at it.
What line of work are you in? This might be an interesting road to go down just for a minute or two before we go. What do you do professionally? And I can only suspect, and I don't know, you may tell me that you're a florist. I can only suspect that that your involvement with amateur radio has affected your professional line of work, and I'd like to hear just a little bit about that, because I find that really interesting in most cases.
Yeah, absolutely. I am currently the vice president of information technology for a small manufacturing company here in Washington. We do all of our business over the internet, and I have both the people that run the machines and the people that program them, and even part of the design staff that work for me. I've been in this career field. I started playing with computers when I was 16 years old, and had the good fortune of a local college that let me come in and play with their computers before it was common to have one available to 16-year-olds. So I've been in that field. Professionally, I did some other things before joining the military in 1980, and was in the computer programming field there. I was in Space Command and worked on some projects up above the Arctic Circle and out in space that had to do with scientific research and computing. And in every case, my ham radio activities have benefited me. When I was in the military, I got some of the assignments I did because I could not only program the computers, but I could run the shortwave networks on military frequencies, even though it wasn't under my AFSC. Worked heavily on the networking side of computing in the 80s, and a lot of that, my knowledge for that came from me doing packet radio, TCP/IP, looking at network protocols and tracing them and understanding them and decoding them and writing code that went into some of those packages. Very much so, ham radio has had a great influence to the positive on my career. I've been able to understand things. I ran a company for a while that was in the warehouse business, and we put in RF-based barcode reading systems, and at another one, I got us licensed on the commercial frequencies for warehouse management, radio systems, and so on. So it's hard to separate the two for me as far as benefit. I've always kept them separate. Understanding amateur radio has its place, and my commercial activities has its place, but they've both grown off of each other, and I just have to say I'm just grateful that we have this hobby. I love it. I even was a radio announcer for a little while. So,
and that was where at?
While I was in college, I worked part-time both at the college as an announcer and for a in-house studio at a cable television company. We did local origination, and I worked as radio announcer, and I ran the film chain, and I did some other things there, as well as climbing poles and hooking wire up.
Well, that's really interesting. If you're talking to a young person right now that's contemplating getting into the hobby, what would you tell that person as far as what the future holds with a ham ticket and what the future might hold without the ham ticket? How would you put it?
Well, you know, part of it's an aptitude and interest. What I would say to young people is that if you like to get in and figure out how things work, ham radio allows you to do that in a way that many other hobbies do not. You have access to very valuable resources. A few years ago, they estimated that a megahertz of radio spectrum was worth over $1 billion, and you have access to billions and billions and billions of dollars worth of radio spectrum as a ham radio operator just for studying a little bit and passing a test. You get practical experience in building not only circuits but systems and debugging them and testing them and experimenting with them without getting your hands slapped for as we talked about earlier at the very beginning of the interview, you'll always have somebody that'll complain about anything, but legally you can do so many things in ham radio that you wouldn't be able to do in the area of communications than any similar type of activity. And it gives you that chance to expand your mind and learn, and then you take that information and you apply it to your chosen field, and it doesn't have to be in a technical field. I know when I first got into ham radio, I was a little bit of a shy teenager, and it gave me the ability to talk to people that might be older than me or have a different cultural background than I have. And I actually had some of those people come and see me. A gentleman that I met over the air came from Australia and visited me in my home, you know, some probably 7,000 miles away, and we visited, and we had a reunion this last year, 27 years later, which was a lot of fun. It's given me the comfort to travel most anywhere in the world. I've worked on five continents, and I've drug ham radio along with me and talked to people locally when I was there, or been able to have contacts with people and ask them about it before I got there. Just all of those things that can add to the richness of your life and your career as you move forward.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on board. This has been enlightening. I've learned quite a little bit. I'm not as ignorant as I was before about D-Star. I can say that. I can say that. It sounds very intriguing. And that's one thing that's beautiful about this hobby is as new technology comes down the pike, you know, it gives you a chance to be part of it. And you know, even now I've heard that that hams during certain circumstances or during certain projects that they're working on can actually get experimental licenses to experiment with different types of RF devices. I'm not sure how that works, but boy, that sounds like an open door to a future Thomas Edison somewhere that
absolutely,
you know, wants to roll up sleeves and just really get into it. But I thank you so much. We'll have to have you back again, and as time goes on, as some more technical advances take place and systems start to change a little bit, you can give us an update on how all that's working, and who knows what you'll be into then. Why don't we give out your website address, which is, I believe it's K7VE, K7VictorEcho.org, O-R-G. Am I correct in that?
That's correct.
All right. Well, I appreciate
it. That's my blog.
You,
all right, Ted.
And you join us again here sometime soon. It operates 20 through 10 meters. It's stealth. It will keep up with any three-element beam and any vertical that you have on your property. But if you can't have a three-element beam or a vertical on your property, you can still have a TW2010. It is stealth. It disappears. We tried to take pictures of it, and we had to move the thing around because it hides so well. There is no compromise in performance with this antenna, and it's portable. You can take it with you on vacation. It's quite unique. They make several flavors of this antenna, however. If you want to operate 80, 40, 60, 30-meter band, it's all there. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com, and check out the special pricing right now.
If you're the decision maker for any form of outdoor lighting, you're going to want to listen to this. The Light Pack Systems induction lights, manufactured in the USA by a severely disabled workforce, uses a unique physical principle of light generation. This lamp system is therefore classified in a new family of sources, the Light Pack Induction Lamp Systems. LightPack induction lighting is a breakthrough for professional, general, and special lighting applications, not only because of its high luminescence and efficiency, but especially because of its unprecedented lifetime. System lifetime is rated at 100,000 hours, or about 20 years, based on 5,000 burning hours per year. With a failure rate of less than 10%. With this unmatched durability, LightPack offers substantial savings in direct maintenance costs as well as indirect costs. Induction lighting is relatively new in the United States, but it's proven technology developed in Europe over 20 years ago. Therefore, claims of durability is based on real-world empirical data, as opposed to estimated design life provided by competitive lighting technologies such as LED. LightPack Systems was founded on the principles of green solutions for modern lighting through strong partnerships with the U.S. military, the University of Central Florida, and several national energy service companies. LightPack offers lighting solutions that provide a better quality of light with a 66% energy savings, also lasting up to 5 times longer than standard lighting options. LightPack's quality shines through with their standard 10-year warranty on all products. Call today for your free demonstration. Go to their website, lightpacksystems.com. That's lightpacksystems.com, spelled LitePackSystems, lightpacksystems.com.
Since the beginning of time and across the history of radio broadcasting, there's only one radio station that has ever earned a full-length documentary dedicated totally and completely to its rise to a pinnacle never before achieved by any radio station, and its fall. This is a story of what happened when the most legendary programming genius of all time takes the reins of an obscure Canadian radio station in the small city of Windsor, Canada, and creates a radio legend that rocked the Motor City, the USA, and half a continent.
That does it for Big Tom Rivers, 1971, and Hank O'Neill starts a brand new year next at CKLW. For the last time this year, I will say to you, rock on, mother!
Ladies and gentlemen, the beat goes on.
CKLW.
2020 news guys, they were disc jockeys without music. Bum, bum, bum. And everybody knew that something was going to happen. You knew something was going to happen.
Motor City Mayor Roman Gribbs has a mad on for an unidentified rapist, a butcher knife-wielding pervert, cornered a secretary in the elevator at Detroit City County Building and rode her to the vacant seventh floor and proceeded to sexually assault her. Guards are now being considered for future surveillance of the crime-stained seventh floor. Lee Marshall, 2020 News.
Now, Markham Street Productions takes you there as you relive the rise and fall of
the Big Gate, CKLW, the Motor City.
You can now own your own copy of this new DVD documentary, Radio Revolution, the Rise and Fall of the Big Eight from Markham Street Productions. The special edition DVD of this award-winning feature-length documentary includes extra scenes, outtakes, photos, and special features. Radio Revolution, the Rise and Fall of the Big Eight, is now available for only $29.95 plus shipping. Go to RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com. Order now while supply lasts. RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com.
And the hits just keep on coming.
CKLW. The Motor City.
Are you needing a place to put up a website? Have you looked around? Do you want to do something that's easy, that's simple, and very, very inexpensive, but yet looks professional? Are you having troubles with your computer? Do you need some tech support help? Are you tired of being connected to India every time you pick up the telephone to get some help on a machine or on a website? The people to call is tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. T-U-X, like tuxedo, dash support, the word support, dot com. These are the people to call. They can get you going. It won't cost you an arm and a leg. You can afford to work with these folks. They're professionals. They answer in plain English, and they can help you do things from a very, very basic, simple standpoint. If you have something that you want to do that's a complex project, well, they can handle that as well. But if you're like I am, when you're trying to put something up on the web or you need help with a computer, you really want somebody that speaks English. And you want it to be simple, and you don't want to have to pay an arm and a leg for it. and you want to deal with some good folks, go to their website, tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, I want to win. Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast. But be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, I want to win. Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, R-A-N-D-A-L-L. And we'll look for your email. Hey, we've got Bobby Raymer with us, N2BR. And Bobby's, he's always up to something. Aren't you, Bobby? Aren't you always up to something?
Right.
But you've got something kind of exciting going on right now, something coming up, and it's a special event station, and I want you to tell us all about this special event station.
Okay. I'll be glad to, Ted. Say hello to everybody that's out there listening, and I hope everybody, wish everybody a Merry Christmas. Starting December the 19th, about 0100 UTC, which is about 7 o'clock p.m. Central Time, until January the 3rd, about 7 p.m., we're going to run a special event station, and our theme is Tennessee Christmas. And we're going to be operating all of the phone bands that we can get on. And we're going to also be running CW. The special call sign is Whiskey for Tango. And it's a Tennessee Christmas celebrating the Christmas holidays coming up. And we're looking to work a lot of stations. We'll have a special QSL card. And if you work us, you just send your QSL along with an SASE and the info, and we'll send you our special event card back. It's supposed to be a nice card. They hadn't got them printed yet, but they will here pretty soon. And like I said, we're going to be 10-3-160 and sideband CW. And we're looking forward to make a lot of contacts. And those shortwave listeners out there, too, if you hear our station, send us a card with an SASE. If you're outside the United States, make sure you have correct IRCs or postage to get a card back from the states to you. And we'll send you a special event card back also. And we're looking forward to having a big time. Several of the operators here, myself, and several of the local operators are going to be on different times of the day and night running. So, you know, it's going to be fun. We're going to run it for 19 days, and we're looking to have a big time.
There you go. Well, now, are you going to be on any particular band more than others, or how much... phone versus CW? Are you going to be running any CW? How's that all going to work?
Well, looks like I'm going to be the one doing the CW, since I do most of the CW compared to the other guys. But
now, are you going to
be?
Are you going to have
in the general portion of the band? That way, it gives everybody a chance that wants to make a contact with us that can. We will be doing some in the extra class portion, but mostly in the general part of the band. And we're going to be, like I said, 160 through 10 meters. If 6 meters pops open a little bit, we may do a little bit on 6 meters too. But that's kind of iffy. You never know about 6 meters. It can be open and nobody there, or it can be dead.
Well, let me ask you, Bobby, are you going to have a chance to learn the code by then?
I might be able to learn the code by then.
Well, this guy here is a CW sleuth. He makes lots of contacts on CW. And right now he's running a TW2010 with 100 watts and working the world in the bottom of the sunspot cycle. So, of course, it seems like now the bottom of the sunspot cycle is going to be here for all eternity. I don't know. I'm beginning to wonder myself. Will they talk about the Maunder minimum or something? I don't know what we're in the middle of. But whatever it is, it's minimum activity. And hopefully we're going to start seeing some activity with these sunspots. We'll be on the upswing of this sunspot cycle. At least that's what we're all hoping for. But checking your log, even though we are in the bottom of the sunspot cycle, why don't you give us a little rundown on your log from last month, what you were able to accomplish last month. We won't even get into this month yet. Just tell me what you did last month. That'd be interesting.
Well, I kind of got full of turkey, so my operating was kind of slack for last month, but I worked, I logged Easter Island, Israel, Slovenia, worked at a couple special events on the Edmunds Fitzgerald. One of the special events I was chasing and got to work was the special event station of the Sullivans. The five Sullivan brothers in Waterloo, Iowa, and I was really pleased to get that. Man, that is a beautiful certificate. Those guys really put some time and effort in that certificate and QSL card. That was a great one. Worked Chesterfield Island and Hostings Island. That's around Papua New Guinea. Mont Surratt Island. And worked several other special events, 6 meter contacts. Worked Hawaii, and let's see, worked St. Croix Island, and that's kind of it. Like I said, I got kind of full of turkey and dressing and all that stuff. My mom cooked for Thanksgiving, so my belly got kind of in the way of. My CW operation for last month, but I managed to make a few contacts.
Well, now let me ask you this question: what bands were you of the contacts you made? What bands were the best? Which bands did you have the best luck on?
Well, let's see. I worked Easter Island on 30, and Israel on 17 meters. 17-meter phone was why I worked Israel. And let's see, Papua New Guinea was on 30. And caught Mont Surratt, I think that's how it's pronounced, island on 15 meters, which I've been hearing 15 meters opening up here lately. It's nice to hear 15 open. I worked... the Hawaiian station on 15 also, and got a good report back from them on 15 meters.
What differences do you notice, say, between the 15 meter band and the 17 meter band? I mean, they are so close together. I mean, do you notice much difference at all?
I noticed, I do. I noticed 17 open a little bit more. I mean, that's not saying that 15 is just dead close, because you know you never know about the band. A lot of people may just be sitting there listening and the band be wide open and nobody talking, and I try to get on 15 some and try to make a little noise. You know, it's kind of like fishing. You throw your line out and you hook, and some days you get a nibble and some days you don't, you know. And I haven't caught 15, you know, much on 15, but when I have, I've managed to work them.
Well, now let me ask you this: you know, with the band being the sunspot activity being at a minimum, and you get on and you're working a lot of DX successfully, how much time do you spend, let's say, calling CQ on a band, And how much activity do you get that way? Or do you listen for stations and then call them when they are obviously in between QSOs? Or how, what works best? Or what have you found to be the, I guess I want to say, the best way to do it or the most fun?
Well, I do a little of both, Ted. I'll get on there and kind of search through the band to see if I'm hearing anything. And if I'm not, I'll, kind of park on a frequency and call CQ for a while. You know, I may spend 30 minutes kind of hopping around a little bit on the 15 meters calling CQ. And, you know, usually by that time, if I don't hear anything or get anything, then I'll switch over to another band. You know, 17, I'll do 17 the same way, and 30, and 40, because there's always somebody on 40 meters, and 20, and I get down on 10 and listen a little bit. Of course, you know, this weekend is the 10 meter ARRL 10 meter contest. I'm gonna be playing in that contest if I can hear anything on the band, because 10's kind of been, it's been quiet here for the last few weeks, and I'm really hoping it pops open. But that's what I do. It's kind of a little of both. I'll listen for a station, and if I hear one, then I'll, you know, wait till I get through working the stations are working, I'll call them, and or, you know, I'll tune around, find me a place, and I'll sit there and call CQ for 30 minutes or so, kind of tune around that portion of the band to, to kind of see what I can kind of fish out.
Well, you know, I guess everybody has their own techniques. There's some folks that never call CQ, you know, and
right.
But do you find, like, for example, I mean, what about when all this, I mean, everybody suggested this, and I've seen this happen, when the band is really open, but there's nobody there. I mean, how many times have you seen this? I mean, where...
many times in my 25 years of amateur radio.
So, I mean, I guess we want to reiterate the fact that when you tune around and you don't hear anything, that doesn't mean the band is dead.
No,
so
it doesn't.
So at that point, obviously, CQ is the only answer. In other words, you have to call CQ. If there's nobody home, there's no one there, you got to call CQ. Well, let me ask you, how many times have you thought or have listened up and down the band? You've heard absolutely nothing. Band is dead for all practical purposes. And so you think the band is not open. And then you go ahead and you call CQ, and lo and behold, all of a sudden you decide, or you not decide, you find out that the band indeed is open, and you get answers.
That's happened several times. I've done that on field day one year. We were set up at field day site over in town, and the bands all kind of sounded like they do right now, just kind of dead, you know.
Uh-huh.
And we had a station on 40, so I couldn't get over 40. And we had a station on 20. We had a station on 75 and 15, so or 10, and so I just left 15. And I thought, well, you know, I'll get over 15. It's dead, but, maybe I might get luck up, get somebody. And I got over 15 meters calling CQ, and I sat there and worked for about 5 hours on 15 meters. I went from hearing nothing, I mean nothing, to sitting there making contacts, and I did for, I don't know, 3-4 hours or so on 15, and I moved down to the CW portion, and the CW was the same way. It was dead. I mean, I didn't hear a soul. Well, I started calling CQ Field Day, and, lo and behold, they come out of the woodwork. And it's kind of odd. You get on the bands sometime, and you sit there and go up and down that band several times, and you don't hear nothing. You don't hear, you don't hear a peep or a snore or anything. And you get on a call CQ, and they come out of the woodwork on you. It's just like they're sitting there chomping, waiting to hear somebody say CQ. And, I look up a lot of times. I'm kind of known to call CQ several times on the band. Sometimes it works, sometimes it don't,
Well, let me ask you this question. What's your impression so far? And I don't want to get into an infomercial, but I think, here's the thing. There's so many people today that that can't have an HF antenna where they live. I mean, some of these subdivisions, they won't even let you put up a clothesline. Clotheslines are outlawed.
Right.
And, you know, you see, just as you go through any city today, you just see all kinds of apartment complexes, condominiums, subdivisions that look like they've been stamped out of a mold. You know, little bitty yards, people with hardly any backyard at all, maybe a balcony. And, right. Of course, all those folks, you know, they're like, well, it's futile. There's no way I can operate any HF at all because of where I live. I just can't do it. Well, you know, and, of course, now here comes the TW2010, and that makes that possible. I mean, I know a lot of fellows that are up in retirement years that love the 20-meter band. But it told me, there's nowhere for me to put an antenna. Anyhow, now you do have the ability to have antennas in the backyard if you really wanted to, if you wanted to put dipoles and stuff up. But you have the TW2010, so tell me a little bit about how has it worked out so far for you as an overall, everyday operational antenna?
Well, let me say this too, Ted. I don't work for TW Antennas. I'm not employed there. You know, I know the people that work there and stuff, and I've got the 2010. I've tried in my years of amateur radio, I've tried several antennas. I've built several dipoles, but I've never had an antenna like this that at the bottom of the cycle, making the contacts I have. You know, and most people are running amplifiers. I don't have an amplifier. I'm running an ICOM 718, and I'm not doing this for commercial. I'm just telling you what I'm running. 100 watts, and I'm running the TW2010. I do have the 40-meter add-on. And, you know, as far as an antenna, I don't need a dipole up. I don't need a beam. That's it. That's what I'm running. And it's, you know, it's like I've asked several times, I don't understand how this antenna works. It works. To look at it, you think, nah, you ain't gonna make nothing with that. But Ted, honestly, I've been really surprised with it. Just really blown away with what I've worked. And you know, I've been around big stations running beams and kilowatt amplifiers and busting pileups and working DX and stuff. But, you know, here I'm sitting here with just a simple, basic station. And, you know, I could put up a dipole. My yard's not really that big for a dipole like I'd like to put up. But I've got high-tension power lines in the back. I've got them in the front yard. And my power line from the pole to the house kind of angles across. So I can't really put a dipole up in the backyard. Because if it failed, it'd get into the power lines, and I can't have that. And the 2010, it's mounted. I've got mine mounted on a permanent mount in the ground. It's right at 3 feet off the ground. I don't have any radials on it. And the great thing, I don't have to have a tuner on it. You know, I don't have to go buy an expensive tuner or a tuner, spend it money for a tuner. I just took the antenna up. And everything, and you know, it's ready to go. if I want to go somewhere and take it, you know, they make a tripod. I just take the antenna off the permamount, and take it with me, and put it on the tripod, and have it together in less than 5 minutes, and be on there.
Now you have. I guess I want to say you have the TW2010, which means you can change bands from inside the house. You don't have to, you know, it's not like the backpacker. The backpacker, you have to go out and change a little slot, which is not that big a deal, but it's just that you have the convenience of being in the wintertime when it's cold.
Yeah, you know? That's one thing I like about the 2010. It's got the little control box, and all I do is just, I do it manually. I think on some of the ICOM and Yaesu radios and stuff, they have a cable that as you change the bands on the radio, it will automatically change on the box. But I don't. I just change mine manually, and and go from there. But yeah, it's a lot nicer to change from inside the house when it's 27 degrees outside.
Well, it's really weird too. When you put the radio, like say on 17 meters on the TW2010, and you start punching the buttons, you punch on the little controller box, which is about double the size of a pack of cigarettes with some LEDs on it, and you punch you punch in 10, and you punch in 12, and then you hit 7 or 15, and then when you hit 17, if the radio is on 17, all of a sudden it comes to life. It's like, it's really weird. It's like each one of the bands, when you have the radio on 20, when you hit the 20 meter button, wham, that thing comes up. You know, it's not it isn't at all like you would expect it to be, like maybe a little bit on the passive side. It's not at all. It's when you're on that band, it comes up. Well, I guess go ahead.
You know, when a lot of times you hear the atmospheric noise and stuff will be kind of rough. The one thing I've noticed with the 2010 is when I switch, I've got another vertical that I run sometime, and when I go to it, my noise level is so bad that a lot of times I can't use it because I'm picking up, you know, with, I'm right in town, so I'm hearing all kinds of light fixtures and power line noise, and I got a transformer around here close that just really gives me a problem sometimes. But I can switch to the 2010, and my atmospheric noise goes away, and the signal, the station I'm trying to listen to, comes up. It's just like turning a preamp on.
Well,
my noise level goes away, or my noise level, most time when I'm running noise, I'm running an S9. When I switch to 2010, my noise level will drop sometime to a S2, S3, but the station in there will come up way up above the noise level. It's just like, you know, turning on a preamp for it. And it's just wild the way it works. And, you know, like I said, I've run several verticals. I've run several dipoles. But this, you know, the 2010, I ain't found nothing that'll beat it.
Well, I guess the thing of it is I found the same thing true. I was very skeptical when I saw this antenna. I said, what in the world is this? You know, and but I've A-B'd it up against the dipole. And you're right, the dipole antenna. Actually, there has been some times when the signals were a little stronger on the dipole, but the noise was so loud. There was so much noise. I'd switch to the 2010, and the overall S-meter reading would drop some, but the noise would drop way down, and the signal would be way over the noise. So it was a real pleasant experience. But most of the time, you are correct. When you were on the dipole and you switch to the 2010, the station signal actually jumps up. You know, and
it does. It's just, you know, it's amazing.
It's weird. It's
what
really
a little
weird
antenna like that will do. I mean, to look at it, you'll laugh at it and say, "How's that work? That thing ain't gonna work. That thing's not gonna hold legal limits." But it does.
Now that's exactly what I said. Well, one thing I think is cool is it hides. It disappears wherever you put it. We tried to take pictures of it, matter of fact, for some promotional shots. We couldn't get a picture of the thing. We had to keep moving it around to find something that we could stick it in front of where you could see the antenna.
Right.
And that's been a problem at the shows. You almost have to run a booth for the antenna because you put it in the back and you've got your desk in front and all that. Everybody's walking around. They don't even see it. So
a white background behind it to see it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the way mine is. You can't see, unless you know that my antenna is back in the backyard, you could walk by. If you didn't know it was there, you wouldn't know it. You wouldn't see it.
It's weird. It's
it blends
very strange
into the background of the yard. And, you know, my next-door neighbor didn't notice it for a while till back in the summer. I was outside, and I came up to the fence and said, what kind of deal you got there? I said, oh, that's just a pot holder for my flares. I said, well, you ain't never seen no flares on it. And I said, well it's, I told them that I was, a ham operator. That was one of my antennas. And they said, you're a ham operator and that's your antenna? I said, yeah. don't hams run big antennas? I said, well, some do. Are you sure that's a ham antenna? I said, yeah.
Well, let's get back real quick to the special event station. The call sign to listen for will be
Whiskey 4 Tango, W4T, And theme for the special event is a Tennessee Christmas. And we'll be operating on 160 through 10 meters, possibly on 6 if we can catch 6 pop open. Jim and I think Jim and Alan and Michael have the capability for 2 meter sideband and 432. They may operate some there if the band will get about right on that frequency. But we're going to be operating sideband and CW on HF bands. We're going to be mostly in the general portion. I don't have really a set frequency. We're just going to kind of find a quiet frequency. You know, 40 meters in the daytime, there's a lot of nets going on, and I don't want to interfere with nobody's net or anything. And we'll just, you know, kind of find a quiet spot in the general part to run. And, you know, we'll be down in the extra class portion too. Operating some, but mostly in the general class portion. That gives everybody a chance to work us all the general class and extra class people can find us. Like I say, we'll be down in the extra class portion some also, and that'll be 160 through 10 meters sideband and CW. And the QSL route is go to QRZ. Under my call sign, November 2 Bravo Radio in 2BR, and I have all the information about the special events there posted. And the special event will start December the 19th. That's next weekend. We'll start about 7 o'clock p.m. Central Time. I think that's 0100. And we'll operate until January the 3rd at 07 p.m. and or 0100, I'll put it that way, UTC. And the QSL, just send us your QSL card with the information and an SASE, and we'll send you back. We're going to have a nice special event QSL card made up. Transworld Antennas is sponsoring the card and also the special event. So we're looking forward to working as many contacts as we can and having a good time and enjoying the radio.
Well, very good, sir. I want to thank you for joining us and getting on here and talking about the special event station and kind of giving us an update on your latest DX activities. Once again, we've been talking to Bobby Raymer and to BR. Be listening for him on the band, mostly on CW. Yeah, bands, I should say.
Can I say this, Ted?
Go ahead.
I'd like to wish everybody a very Merry Christmas and a very happy, safe, and prosperous New Year, and I look forward to working you guys on the bands. Look for me on CW, and you can find me sometime in the phone portion. But like to wish everybody a very Merry Christmas.
And he's going to do his best to learn CW by this contest coming.
Yeah, I'm going to hope so.
Well, thank you much, sir. In this day and time, what we don't have much of is time. And if you enjoy operating and you just don't get a chance to, you need to take a look at the Transworld antennas, TW2010, and all the models that operate the different bands. Go to YouTube and put in Transworld antennas and see how simple this thing is to set up. I mean, it is easy. It goes together fast. And, of course, that gives you more time to operate. You're not fussing around with an antenna. In an emergency situation, it is absolutely necessary. You need to have one of these, if not for yourself, for your club, or whoever it is that may get called out on a scene where you've got to operate and you've got to be able to set up quickly and efficiently. Go to their website, and that's transworldantennas.com. Transworldantennas.com. There's a link up there to YouTube, and you can see how quickly this antenna sets up, how easy it is to operate. Transworldantennas.com. At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, I want to win. Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast. But be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, I want to win. Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, RANDALL. And we'll look for your email. That's going to do it for this edition of QSO. We want to thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening. Once again, a special thanks to our guests, K7VE John Hayes from Seattle, Washington, and W2BR Bobby Raymer from Cookeville, Tennessee. Be sure and tune again next time around for another QSO.